Ukraine's president has a message for his citizens today. They need to defend themselves with guns, with anything.
Be ready to throw Molotov cocktails and fight the Russians as much as they can.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, thousands of anti-war protesters have gone into Russian streets, risking arrest. Others are more private in their disapproval.
I'm suffocating with a feeling of shame and remorse for the government. My country, the government that I haven't voted for.
And in Poland, the government and the public are preparing for Ukrainians fleeing the war next door.
We receive really dozens of offers every day of people who want to contribute their own flats, their own homes.
That will be needed. More Ukrainians are on their way to Poland. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for making it here on this Friday, the end of a long week. Today in Ukraine, Russian military forces are closing in on the capital, Kyiv. Ukrainian soldiers took up defensive positions. At least one apartment building was badly damaged by shelling. Videos appeared to show Russian troops entering the northern suburbs of the city. Gunfire was heard. Russian President Vladimir Putin called on Ukraine's military to overthrow its own government. In a few minutes, we'll get the view from Moscow. First, though, to Kyiv. Reporter Jessica Gallagher is there. Jessica, tell us where you are and what you've seen today.
Today has been an interesting day. We had the missile strikes early this morning, about the same time they started yesterday at 5 a.m., and then a lot of air raid sirens today, just continually. And just right before I spoke with you, we had several missile strikes right near my hotel, which is essentially right in the city center. People here are out and about more than they were yesterday. People were queuing up at the banks, at grocery stores, at the apotheca or the pharmacy in order to get much needed medication. And Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has essentially told Ukrainians to get guns. If they can't get guns, the government will help them get guns, to be ready to throw Molotov cocktails and to fight the Russians as much as they can.
So as far as Ukraine's government urging people to fight back, making Molotov cocktails, they're apparently getting weapons to fight Russian troops. Have you seen any signs of that happening?
Absolutely. Yesterday, I went to the grocery store just to interview some people. There were two gentlemen in front of me, and this one gentleman had the biggest gun I have ever seen. I think it was a pistol. I'm not well-versed into weapons, but they were talking about how they were ready to fight and, you know, the Russians are never going to win. And we also see a lot of, like, if you do go out on the street, the people that you see are men. You're not seeing a lot of women. And a lot of them say that they're ready. And when you have the president saying, you know, don't give up a fight, a lot of people are ready to do that.
There is that order for 18 to 60-year-old Ukrainian men to remain in the country and fight the Russians. Have many of those men served in Ukraine's military, and do they know how to use the weapons they're getting from the government?
This is the million-dollar question. So Volodymyr Zelensky even said on Thursday night when he made this decree to mobilize the army, the full army, essentially, he said, I don't know how many people we have. I don't know how much money we have, but we have to do it. And I think that says it all.
So, Jessica, that detail you mentioned earlier, that in the city center of Kyiv, shelling by the Russians and people are out and about. I mean, that's kind of extraordinary. What is the overall mood in the city as you've seen it?
I think it depends on who you talk to. I've seen, quite frankly, and this really goes to the spirit of the Ukrainian people, a lot of humor. I mean, I've had some really good conversations. There's also in Ukraine, it's very religious. Obviously, it used to be the Russian Orthodox Church. Now it's Ukrainian. People pray. And another thing that I've seen people do, and this is so lovely, they're very helpful. You see the babushki in the grocery store that can't carry their bags or can't do their groceries. And I've seen many people helping other people. Yes, I'm sorry, the elderly, and just helping other people. And there's not as much quick-temperedness as there usually is here.
Is there worry among Ukrainians about President Zelensky's safety right now?
Absolutely, because some of the intelligence that the United States and Western leaders are getting is that Russian forces have been in the city center way before this happened. And they're watching and waiting. The fact that they've entered the northern part of the city for Ukraine's government is not good either. But the thinking is that they're already here.
Finally, Jessica, in Kyiv itself, how large and visible is the presence of Ukrainian military forces? And does it look like there could be a prolonged fight for control of the capital?
I think that they are, well, we know that they are on the front lines fighting. And they have made many grounds against Russia, especially in the south. Volodymyr Zelensky offered to have talks with Russia today once he learned that the Russians had officially entered Kyiv. And the Russians actually said, okay, yeah, we're willing to have talks in Belarus. And perhaps that has to do with the fact that Ukraine's military has made significant gains against the Russians in the south, but it also could be this bitter pill, this fake invitation. But I, quite frankly, have not seen them a lot. And I expected more, having lived in Russia during the mass protests, the biggest since the collapse of the Soviet Union, to see more troops. I really did. I mean, I saw more troops in Russia on a daily basis than I have here in Kyiv in a time of war. But maybe that says it all. They don't have a large military.
Keeping us on top of the latest, that's reporter Jessica Gallagher in Kyiv. Jessica, thank you very much for updating us. Be safe.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky told his country this morning, quote, "The fate of Ukraine depends only on Ukrainians." He also had a message for Russians.
Всім гражданам Російської Федерації, які виходять на протести, хочу сказати, ми вас видим.
Zelensky praised Russian citizens protesting the war right now. He said, quote, "We see you, and that means you heard us, and you're beginning to believe us." One of those publicly standing against the Russian invasion is Elena Chernyenko, a foreign affairs correspondent with a Kommersant newspaper in Moscow. This week, she penned an open letter signed by journalists and experts in Russia condemning Russia's war against Ukraine. Elena, what made you decide to organize this letter?
Well, I just woke up in the morning when I heard about the military operation of Russia in Ukraine. I just thought that this is not something that I support. I communicated with other colleagues and they had the same feelings, that we think that military option is not a way to resolve conflicts and that we believe in diplomacy. And I mean, I'm writing about diplomacy for many years. We fully understand that there is so many different aspects to this conflict, but still, peace and negotiations and diplomacy are the way to go and not a military operation. That's why we wrote a letter for peace.
You are a high-profile journalist in Russia. I think listeners need to understand that. So what consequences have followed for you since this letter went public?
Well, I've had difficulties with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs that I'm covering for many years. It seems that I've been expelled from the press pool of the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, being accused of an unprofessional mixture of my personal opinion with my journalistic work, which I don't agree with. But this is a minor thing. I mean, the most important thing is that we all want to pray for peace and that not Russia, not the Ukrainians. We shouldn't be in this situation. I do have personally relatives in the Donbas, so I know how hard it was for the people there during these 8 years and how victimized they felt from the government in Kyiv that called them terrorists just because they didn't agree with the Maidan.
The protests in Kyiv.
Yeah, exactly. They felt that they are not only Ukrainian, but Ukrainian-Russian. But I still think that even very, very unjust things in one region, they don't justify unjust and violent operations in another region.
Elena, how many more Russians support the opinion in your and the other journalists' letter and are not speaking out?
That's hard to say because I have not seen very recent polls about the military operation going on. There was a poll before the operation started, which said that about half of the people that participated in the poll here in Russia, they were afraid of a war with Ukraine, and the other half was not afraid. They didn't feel the danger of a war. So I think probably the opinion is just as divided. Maybe half of the population are supportive of the government's decision to launch this operation, but at least just as many, maybe a bit less, I don't know. But many people are feeling that this is not the way to go, that diplomacy should have been given another chance.
How do you explain Putin's decision to invade Ukraine to your readers or even to yourself?
Well, we basically quote as much as possible of Vladimir Putin's statements. I think the last statements and addresses to the nations that he made, they make an impression that he is genuinely feeling what he says, that he really seems to think that this operation will bring long-lasting peace to Ukraine. We don't try to explain it. We quote it and we give it the way it is, because it really seems, I mean, if you watch these statements, it seems that he is personally very much involved and emotional about the things that he's saying. So I think we should take it as it is, not try to kind of circumvent and apply other logic to this.
In recent days, there have been some anti-war protests in Russia. How unusual is that? And what kind of risk are people taking when they go out to protest?
Well, usually there isn't much protest about things in Russia because the population is very apolitical. So it's quite unusual that people go out to protest for political things. We have seen quite a lot of young people on the street. It feels that they have been very emotionally taken by these events and that they really care for what is happening. And they have a very peaceful message that the war has to end.
Elena, as you said, you have personal connections in Ukraine. Who have you been in touch with in recent days, and what have you been hearing?
Well, we've got parts of the family of my husband, but also friends of mine have their parents there. They live in the Donbas, in the part which is now the independent republics of Donetsk and Lugansk. And they feel for the first time in many years that they are in a safe place, that war seems to be ending for them. Most of the people that I've been talking to in the region there, they actually don't think that this is enough. They would like their regions to join Russia, to become part of Russia. Most of them have Russian passports. They send their kids to education in Russia. They get their pensions in Russia, and their hopes are with Russia. But also we have been witnessing people that have fled this region during the evacuation, and some of them have been telling their stories. And many of them think that if maybe the government in Kyiv would have treated them differently, they would then prefer to stay in Ukraine because they feel Ukrainian. So it's a big mix of many, many aspects and people that have been hurt from all sides.
As I said earlier, Elena, you're one of the top foreign affairs journalists in Russia. How much has Putin's decision to start this war changed your view of him and his inner circle? Has this been a kind of turning point for you?
Well, I must say that I personally, I don't know if I can say if I have been in denial or maybe I didn't really understand what was going on in the last months. I really believe these demands that Russia has voiced diplomatically and then this buildup of the military at the Ukrainian border to be part of a kind of a big chess game in diplomacy where we kind of press a bit and then we get results that was hard to get before. Then there will be negotiations, maybe big summits. And this will really influence the way that the security architecture is shaped in Europe. So I really would not have believed that we would end up in a military operation.
Elena Chanyenka, a foreign affairs correspondent with the Kommersant newspaper, speaking with us from Moscow. She organized an open letter speaking out against Russia's war with Ukraine. Elena, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
We'll hear more from Russians who oppose the war later in the show. You're listening to The World.
The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thousands of people have been attempting to get out of Kyiv as Russia bombs parts of the capital. Volodymyr Solohub was one of those people. He's a journalist we spoke with yesterday as he was preparing to leave. So, Volodymyr, were you able to get out of Kyiv, and where are you now?
Yeah, Marco, just a few hours ago, I arrived to Lviv, which is a major city in West Ukraine, very close to the border with Poland. My journey from Kyiv to Lviv was quite an ordeal of almost 20 hours.
Wow. What was the train ride like? Because yesterday you spoke about trying to get a ticket and everything was sold out.
That train ride was something definitely out of the ordinary. I don't think I will ever forget. I saw, you know, all the seats were taken. Some of the people were standing. It was obvious that all of these people were fleeing Kyiv in hopes of finding safety in Western Ukraine. That's where the train was headed. Also, there were lots of foreigners on the train, young people, most of them students. I spoke to a group of students from Colombia. There were about like 15 of them. They were studying digital marketing in Kyiv, and now they were trying to flee Ukraine, and they just were, you know, first year students. So they just got into the country, they just settled in and are now faced with, you know, this disaster. Because this train after Lviv was continuing to Poland, the closer we're getting to Lviv, the more I was seeing it like a refugee train, because women with their children were getting on the train to try and go into Poland. And the reason for that is that recently Ukraine imposed a restriction for men aged between 18 and 60 to leave the country.
And the reason for that is they're being conscripted for fighting, correct?
That's absolutely correct. There is a nationwide conscription call, and there are lines of even volunteers at these military recruitment centers or territorial defense centers who want to join, who want to go and fight against the Russians. So now it's basically only women and children who can leave the country. So this train was filling up with people. And because nobody was checking the tickets, basically they were letting in everyone on the train who wanted to go. Just come in and we'll take you to Lviv or to Poland, wherever you need. Another story, Marco, which basically, again, blew my mind during the train ride. A guy who was sitting next to me, he told me that his wife and his daughter, by pure luck, flew out of Kyiv to Poland just one day before the invasion. And this was just pure luck for them, because obviously once the invasion started, the airspace was closed. So when he was on this train, he wasn't sure if he would be allowed to go beyond Lviv into Poland and cross the border, because he was in this age group, 18 to 60. And I overheard him talking to someone on the phone, asking if they could smuggle him through the border.
Wow. Wow. Do you worry about Russian troops getting to Lviv, and do you have another plan after that?
I don't know. I have no plan whatsoever what I'm going to do if the war comes here to Lviv, because basically there's nowhere else we can go. We can't go abroad, so I think we'll just have to start fighting.
Volodymyr Solohub, who left Kyiv yesterday and is now in Lviv in western Ukraine, thank you very much for speaking with us again. Stay safe.
Thank you, Marco.
The UN's refugee agency estimates 100,000 Ukrainians have fled their homes so far, seeking safety from the Russian invasion. Many of them are crossing into Poland. The Polish government is setting up reception centers and hospitals to help new arrivals. Earlier this month, Poland said it would accept up to 1 million Ukrainian refugees. Agnieszka Kosowicz is president and founder of the Polish Migration Forum and joins us from Warsaw. How many people are crossing the Ukrainian border into Poland right now, and where exactly are they going?
We know about dozens of thousands of people that have already crossed overnight, and we also know about the queue of about 100,000 people that are on the Ukrainian side waiting basically to be allowed into Poland. We also talk about millions, and it's hard to imagine how Poland will cope with this, to be frank.
So let's start at the main border crossings. What does that look like right now?
Long queues of people that have been stuck on the border for the last 24 hours. So we still have people waiting that have arrived to the border yesterday. And very many of them are women with children, because the Ukrainian border guards do not allow men out. So this is a challenge with women with the kids stuck there for hours.
I saw some video last night of Ukrainians who had just crossed into Poland. They were at a rest area with a cafe and restaurant that were open late at night. How big a relief is it for them just to get across the border into Poland?
Well, for any refugee, crossing a border means that they feel safe and they can take a deeper breath. But then on the other hand, the people that we talk to very often talk about the families that were left behind. So yes, people are happy to be in a safe place, but on the other hand, they are very concerned about the loved ones or family members that are left behind.
Agnieszka, tell us more about the reception centers and the hospitals. What preparations has Poland been making?
Well, I have to say that this is something that is happening right now because Poland, the traditional network of reception centers that we used to have for refugees in Poland was designed for a capacity of 3,000, 3,500 people. So any numbers that we are talking about now are already overwhelming for the system that used to work. So whatever happens now is just being created. I have to say that there is a huge people's initiative and a lot of goodwill among the simple people, regular people that live and offer help to Ukrainians. In, even in our foundations, we receive really dozens of offers every day of people who want to contribute their own flats, their own homes, or small hotels or different kinds of facilities where people can be helped.
Well, Poland's government has taken a staunch stance against migrants. Authorities in recent months have blocked refugees from coming through the Polish border with Belarus. So can you help us understand why Poland seems open to Ukrainian refugees, but people from other parts of the world, Afghanistan or Eritrea, that seems to be a bridge too far for some people?
If you talk to people, everybody has their own rationale and way of thinking. I believe that politics or historical reasons play an important role because Poland and Russia are not best of friends. And basically in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, a lot of Poles are on the Ukrainian side. So, you know, enemy of your enemy is your friend. I don't know if you have this saying in English.
Yes, we do. Yeah. What kind of policy changes are you advocating for now? I know you've been meeting with Polish government officials.
Yes, we are advocating actually exactly for the topic of our RUST exchange on situation of not only Ukrainians. This is one change. And we also lobby for legalization of whatever happens, because in this initial moment where the government opens the borders, I think it's easy to forget that these people will have to live here on the longer term. And it's important from the start to make order in what rights they have, what rights they don't have, access to medical help, labor market. And we believe that at the moment this is not being discussed enough. And basically from my perspective, it is very important.
Agnieszka Kosowicz, president and founder of the Polish Migration Forum, talking with us about Ukrainians who are crossing the border into Poland. She's in Warsaw. Agnieszka, very good to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. Hello, it's Marco. In October 2021, we set an ambitious goal of raising $67,000 for The World. Before the end of the year, we had raised over $86,000. This is an incredible feat we could not have done alone. Here are some of the people who made that possible. Robert Briggs, Rick Brooks, Kenneth Bolko, John Cameron, Ann Campbell, Jennifer Clemens, Rachel Elhus, Lucy Fellows, Eden Furtak-Cole, Lori Garrison. Thanks to everybody who answered the call and for those who continue to listen to the show every day. Wealthy Russian oligarchs have long stashed their money in London.
We've identified over £6.5 billion worth of suspicious wealth.
Now it's hoped that new sanctions will ferret out that dirty money.
And that means oligarchs in London will have nowhere to hide.
And we look at the history of missed opportunities to rein in Putin, coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Over the past 2 days in Moscow, St. Petersburg, and more than 50 cities across Russia, thousands of people have turned out for anti-war protests. Demonstrators have been quickly arrested. Others are speaking more privately about their opposition to the war President Putin launched. The World's Duri Buscarin heard from some of them.
When Russians woke up yesterday morning, the news that Putin was bombing Ukraine came as a shock.
In the middle of the 21st century, you never expected to have this, really. You never expected And my heart goes out to people in the Ukraine whom I know, whom I don't know, who are subjected to such suffering.
We are not naming most of the Russians who spoke to us in this segment. Criticizing the government in Russia can result in arrest or even jail time, so we asked people to send us voice notes over encrypted messaging services. This woman, from a city in central Russia, says she felt ashamed.
I'm suffocating with a feeling of shame and remorse for the government of my country, the government that I haven't voted for. I feel alienated from a lot of my compatriots who support the government.
On Russian television, broadcasters stick to the government's talking points, avoiding any pictures or mentions of casualties.
В этих условиях Москва начала военную операцию по демилитаризации и денацификации Украины.
In this one, a broadcaster says that the Kremlin has, quote, begun a military operation for the demilitarization and denazification of Ukraine. He says this is not Russia's war with Ukraine and certainly not an occupation. This is the liberation of Ukraine from their status as a colony with a puppet regime. Despite the Kremlin's chokehold on Russia's mainstream media sources, a fair number of Russians do not support the war.
It was like a nightmare. I couldn't believe until the last moment. It was like something beyond consciousness. Fortunately, immediately colleagues and friends began to gather signatures.
This speaker is an independent journalist in Russia. 170 journalists and experts signed a petition against the war. Thousands more joined petitions online.
We need peace, and many Russian people stand for peace. We do not think that Ukrainian people are our enemies. We do not think that Ukraine is an enemy state.
In this video, posted to social media by a Wall Street Journal reporter, protesters in Moscow quietly chant, "No to war." About 1,400 Russians were arrested overnight in anti-war rallies that cropped up across the country. Oleg Ignatov in Moscow is a senior analyst for the crisis group. He says the turnout was small if you consider that 12 million people live in Moscow. But others oppose the war in more private ways.
Because there are a lot of Russian nationalists who don't support the war against Ukrainians. Because for them, Ukrainians are brother nations, yes.
Many Russians have family and friends in Ukraine, Ignatov says. But others do support Putin's territorial ambitions.
Most of the people who support this war, they want to see Russia as a great power. And they can't accept that the Ukrainians are sovereign. And they can't accept that Ukrainians want to be part of Europe.
Ignatov says this invasion is a stark contrast to Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014. Back then, Putin tried very hard to get public opinion on his side. This time, he doesn't seem to care.
Crimea was a matter of unity, and this war is a matter of division. And I absolutely believe that this war will divide Russian society.
For the world, I'm Dary Buscarin.
London has long been a magnet for Russian oligarchs looking to hide their wealth. The British capital even has the nickname Londongrad. Yesterday, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced a new round of harsher sanctions against Russia. He said it's time to squeeze Russia from the global economy piece by piece. But will the measures actually tackle the problem of dirty Russian money in London? The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports.
Belgrave Square in central London is a stone's throw from Buckingham Palace. The street is lined with elegant 19th century houses worth millions of dollars. It's also known as Red Square.
It is because historically, from the 90s, a series of Russian oligarchs have been buying properties around the square.
Roman Borisovich is a former investment banker and now anti-corruption campaigner. He used to run what he called kleptocracy tours through exclusive neighbourhoods in London.
You have to understand that Russia is an absolute kleptocracy. The corrupt political elite plunders the country, robs blind its own citizens, its fellow taxpayers, and the money doesn't stay in Russia, it comes here.
But it's hard to know just how much illicit Russian money actually ends up in Britain. Transparency International, the anti-corruption watchdog, says many Russian-owned properties in the UK are bought anonymously through shell companies registered abroad. Duncan Hames is the group's director of policy.
We've identified over £6.5 billion worth of suspicious wealth in principally real estate in the United Kingdom. Of that, £1.5 billion is owned by Russians who are either accused of corruption or have close links to the Kremlin.
Hames says those figures are only the tip of the iceberg. Earlier this week, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson promised to crack down on some of that suspicious wealth. On Tuesday, he announced sanctions on 3 Russian oligarchs and 5 small banks. Opposition lawmakers, like Labour's Margaret Hodge, said the measures were totally inadequate.
There are serious flaws in the new sanctions regime. Yeah. Unlike US legislation, it's limited in how we can sanction Russian government officials. Yeah. That means that kleptocrats who have stolen from the Russian people and support Putin would not be caught. Yeah.
Then yesterday, as Russia launched a full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Boris Johnson changed tack.
The UK is announcing the largest and most severe package of economic sanctions that Russia has ever seen.
Johnson said the assets of all major Russian banks in Britain will be frozen, and more than 100 individuals, including Putin's former son-in-law and Russia's youngest billionaire, will be sanctioned. Government critics are asking why it's taken so long for the Prime Minister to take action. Ian Blackford, a lawmaker with the Scottish National Party, has a theory.
The truth is that Russian oligarchs who give the right people in power a golden handshake have been welcomed into London for years. Their activities weren't stopped, they were encouraged. And plenty of these golden handshakes just so happened to find their way into the coffers of the Conservative Party.
Britain's Labour Party claims the Conservatives have received more than $2.5 million in donations from Russia since Boris Johnson came to power over 2 years ago. It's not just real estate companies or political parties in Britain that seem to be benefiting. Casey Michel is an investigative journalist and author of the new book, American Kleptocracy.
The British legal industry, the British accountancy industry, and so many other industries were taking a part of that profit as well. And then beyond that, some of that money began trickling into the nonprofit sectors. You had universities that were taking some of this money. There was this kind of potpourri of questionable Russian wealth coming in and all kinds of different British industries.
Michelle tells me there's another reason why so many corrupt Russians like London so much.
It's also the ability that these Russian oligarchs have to use the British courts against especially British investigative journalists. I mean, Orla, I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with my journalistic counterparts in the United Kingdom who have been chilled into self-censorship because of these concerns about how open, how available things like libel lawsuits are in the United Kingdom.
Michelle says oligarchs in the UK aren't just laundering money, they're laundering their reputations too. Many like to send their children to elite British schools, which can cost up to $70,000 a year. Duncan Hames with Transparency International says his group has warned the schools about the issue.
The schools themselves need to take care that they are not receiving illicit wealth when their fees are paid.
Yesterday, Boris Johnson also promised to bring forward the Economic Crime Bill. It's a new law that could reveal the true owners of offshore companies that invest in UK properties. And Johnson vowed to crack down on dodgy Russian investors.
We will set up a new dedicated kleptocracy cell in the National Crime Agency to target sanctions evasion and corrupt Russian assets hidden in the UK. And that means oligarchs in London will have nowhere to hide.
Anti-corruption campaigners have welcomed the news. But today, many are asking why it took Russia invading Ukraine for Boris Johnson to finally tackle oligarchs and their wealth in London. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
This week marks 50 years since President Richard Nixon took his groundbreaking trip to the People's Republic of China. That trip ended 25 years of diplomatic silence between the U.S. and China, a reestablishing of relations. It was seen even by Nixon's critics as a remarkable moment for a free market conservative intent on finding some way to establish a relationship with hardcore communists. On the flight from Washington to Beijing, he got the ground rules from National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger.
I don't need to pay any attention, but they always start on the second. And they're never late.
Start on the second and end on the hour.
But I think they...
It's noteworthy these days when heads of state spend one night in a place and then leave. Nixon was in China for a full week, soaking up everything he could. The Great Wall of China was the photo op of the trip.
Machinery or equipment at the time, it had to all be done by hand. Under the circumstances, it is a certainly symbol of what China in the past has been and what China in the future can become.
At the end of the week, as he was about to depart Beijing for Washington, Nixon spoke.
As we look back over this week, we think of the boundless hospitality that has been extended to all of us by our Chinese friends. We have today seen the progress of modern China.
But aside from what Nixon saw and the leaders he spoke with, what does his visit to China 50 years ago mean today? Isaac Stonefish is a former Beijing correspondent and the author of a new book called America Second, How America's Elites Are Making China Stronger. Isaac, give us a quick reminder of why this trip was so historic.
It brought China back from the cold. It brought them into the global world that we live in. And it was such a major reversal for Nixon, who is a notorious anti-communist. And it showed that leaders like Nixon and Kissinger could put aside their ideologies to try and figure out a way to work with the People's Republic of China.
So one of the American elites you single out in the book is Henry Kissinger. We heard him earlier giving Nixon advice ahead of this trip. Take us back to 1972. What role did Kissinger play in strengthening the bonds with China and in the years after this trip?
So in my book, I give Kissinger a lot of credit for the work that he did while in office as Secretary of State and National Security Advisor on creating a relationship with China. I think that was very valuable, and I do not think that that was a diplomatic mistake. I think the issue for Kissinger was in 1982, he formed a company called Kissinger Associates and basically retired being an elder statesman and became a business person. And there's nothing wrong with being a business person, but the issue was that Kissinger, over the last 40 years, tried to steer U.S.-China relations in a way that was beneficial for his business, for himself, and for the Communist Party, often at the expense of the American people, trying to emphasize the positive, ignoring Chinese human rights abuses, ignoring issues of Chinese companies' predatory practice, or what Chinese were doing to their minority populations. And it was really just trying to focus on the positive, on issues such as quote unquote friendship or developing deeper ties. And his name just appears throughout in so many surprising ways. 1997, the Bond film Tomorrow Never Dies is the first Hollywood movie rewritten to be less critical of China. And why did they rewrite it? Because someone in the studio talked to Kissinger and he recommended it.
No kidding. Isaac, as you look back, was what Kissinger did, was it counterproductive? Because in the U.S., we've seen an uptick in hate crimes against Asian Americans in the wake of the pandemic. We have the dark lessons of history, Japanese Americans sent to prison camps during World War II. Lives of many Americans were ruined during the Cold War when they were suspected as communists. How does the U.S. push back against China without fueling stereotypes and bigotry now?
That's a really important question. I don't fault Kissinger for that, and I do really condemn the deplorable rise of hate crimes against Chinese Americans and the specter of McCarthyism, which is a stain on our history. I think the issue is more one of corruption than ideology and race. Many former U.S. officials were advocating for policies beneficial to them and seeming like independent-minded pundits when really they were business people. And I think the way to solve this is less to focus on Chinese Americans, less to accuse people of being communists, and more to have much stronger restrictions on lobbying, on advocating, really cleaning up the revolving door between the government and business, which has been a problem for every administration, Republican and Democrat, and Kissinger is just the most egregious example of that.
So there were U.S.-China relations before Nixon's trip to China, and there were those relations after that trip. On balance, what changed fundamentally?
Some of it was perception that the other side was made up of human beings, which I think is incredibly important for both sides to know. The U.S. and China, until the fall of the Soviet Union, had a pretty robust intelligence sharing program. There was a lot of trade ties that really grew. And I mean, the relationship has been so fascinating to chart over these last 50 years. First, it was about countering the Soviet Union. Then, after the fall of the Soviet Union and the Tiananmen Square massacre, the idea was, oh, I think we need to work with China so that we can bring trade and democracy to China. Well, I think we all know how that ended. And now I think we're trying to figure out how do we have the relationship between the world's two most powerful economies.
Is there a window of opportunity for Washington to get Beijing on the U.S. side right now? And how would the White House do that, given the worrisome signs of authoritarianism and human rights abuses in China?
It's a really important question. There's always ways to do that. And the question is, would the U.S. have to be giving up too much in order to do that? And, you know, what Beijing really wants is a free hand to seize Taiwan, but that is really inimical to U.S. interests. And so the question is, what levers can the U.S. push? How can they paint China as an irresponsible global player for working with Russia? You know, should they sanction Chinese entities that are helping Russia right now? How hard should they push? These are really, really good questions that are being debated in the White House today.
Isaac Stonefish, the author of America Second, How America's Elites Are Making China Stronger. Thank you for talking about all of this and for taking us back to 1972 and Nixon's trip there.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to chat.
Vladimir Putin has been Russia's president for close to two decades. Under his leadership, Russia has annexed Crimea, sent troops into Ukraine, propped up a sympathetic government in Belarus, assassinated opponents in foreign countries, and meddled in elections, including in the U.S. Launching a war on Ukraine is just the latest example of his aggression. How has Putin continued to get away with it? Sam Green is the director of the King's Russia Institute at King's College London and co-author of the book Putin versus the People. Let's go back to the beginning, Sam. 1999, Putin's first term as president. Remind us how Putin, this former KGB officer, emerged as Russia's leader. Where was Russia in the world at the time, and how did that factor into his worldview?
Well, Russia was really struggling to find its footing, right? We were less than a decade after the end of the Soviet Union. Russia had experienced a major financial collapse and default in 1998. The president at the time, Boris Yeltsin, was ailing and was struggling to keep sort of his government together, keep business on side, keep the oligarchs on side, keep the people on side. And those around him began looking for a successor, somebody they thought maybe that they could manage, but who also would maybe be a little bit more predictable in office. And that was Putin.
Yeah, so a dark horse of sorts, quietly waiting in the wings. How does all this explain Putin's desire to restore Russia's place on the world stage or reestablish it as a superpower, the sort of imperial Russian ambition?
There were certainly some things that Putin knew very early. You know, Putin had been a KGB agent working in East Germany at the time that the Soviet Union fell apart. And he tells this story about how East Germans were essentially at the gates of his station, and he was calling Moscow for instructions. And at some point, Moscow simply stopped answering the phone. And it was at that point that he realized that the country that he thought he was serving didn't really exist anymore. And I think that has stuck in his mind as something that really the state always needs to be strong. The state always needs to be coordinated and always able to defend its interests. But as things began to happen in other places where he felt that he had allies in the government of Milosevic in Serbia, when that government fell and revolutions that then brought down autocratic regimes in Georgia and in Ukraine, 2004, 2005, he began to feel that the West had it in for people who ruled their countries the way he did, and had it in potentially for his regime as well.
In 2014, Russia invaded Ukraine for the first time. What opportunities did other powers like NATO, the US, Europe, the UN have to prevent that?
Not very many. The reality, though, is that the NATO position and the US position has been clear throughout both the Georgia and the Ukrainian conflict, which is that nobody is going to countenance a scenario in which American troops or NATO troops more broadly could ever be forced to get into a firefight with the Russian military, because the costs of escalation in that scenario are too catastrophic to contemplate.
But since Putin started to take his aggressive moves, do you believe the West missed opportunities along the way that maybe could have changed Putin's trajectory? Like, what could have been done to bring Putin to heel along the way?
I think there's an argument to be made that had sanctions been more sweeping, that things might have looked different. I think one of the things that sanctions were designed to do was to change the calculation, not necessarily for Putin himself, but for the political and the economic elite on whose behalf we believe Putin rules. Right? So to make it clear that to them that a future with Putin will be poorer, more tenuous, less mobile, and less enjoyable than a future without Putin. What's been done so far, right, has not been enough to sort of outstrip the ability of the Russian state to account for that, to mitigate that.
Putin is also engaged in election meddling here in the U.S. He's propped up dictators from Belarus to Syria. Many believe he ordered the killing of a Russian intelligence agent in the U.K. Why does Putin see all this as necessary to Russia's foreign policy?
You know, part of Putin's learning process over the last 22 years or so has been that he no longer believes that he can run Russia the way that he wants to run it, the way that he believes it needs to be run, and secure his own place in that power structure. He needs a Russia that is much more autonomous, in some ways much more autarkic, and much more protected from Western power directly and in terms of soft power. He needs a Russian elite and a Russian society and a Russian economy that in many ways are much less dependent on the West. And so I think he's actually quite happy in some respects to see significant barriers. And he's clearly not bothered by the fact that Europe and NATO and the US are marshaling their forces on the other side of those lines. Secure, of course, in the understanding that he's not going to be militarily attacked by NATO.
And with Ukraine, I mean, he's violated international law. Amnesty International says Russia's military has already committed war crimes. Are you surprised by any of this, Sam, given Putin's two-decade record?
If anything, I'm a little heartened to see that the war has not yet at least been as destructive as it could be. If we look at the way Russia conducted its war in Chechnya and the way Russia has conducted its operations in Syria, they have essentially carpet bombed cities with little regard to loss of human life and innocent civilians. That hasn't so far been the strategy in Ukraine. I don't have reason to believe that it ever would have been, but the Russian military has form on that. I think that Putin is, while a dictator for all intents and purposes, still sensitive to a degree to Russian public opinion. So Russian public opinion is not necessarily behind that kind of war and would not be happy to see their military causing wanton destruction in cities that, of course, many Russians have relatives in, a lot of Russians were born in, and with which Russian citizens in many cases feel a lot of affinity.
So in the long run of history, how do you think Vladimir Putin is going to be remembered?
It's very difficult for me to see a way in which he comes out of this as anything but a criminal, right? This is going to be hugely destructive, obviously, for Ukraine. It will be hugely destructive for Russia in terms of the economic prospects of generations. It will probably, we're already seeing, increasing crackdowns in Russia. It will overturn Russian politics for a long time. And of course, it forces Europe into a much more militarized sense of its own security, and that will damage what could otherwise have been a century of prosperity.
Sam Green is the director of the King's Russia Institute at King's College London and co-author of Putin versus the People. Sam, thank you.
Thank you.
We leave you today with a selection from Consolation No. 3 by Franz Liszt, performed by Vladimir Horowitz. Horowitz was born in Ukraine. He studied in Kiev at the conservatory while the Bolsheviks were seizing much of his family's property. Still, Horowitz performed all over Russia in the early 1920s, but he left in 1925, never to return again. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston, online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll be back with you on Monday.